This podcast is part of the Arya Kunz Public Program for 2022-2023, curated by Bao. We dedicate this, our seventh session of Reading Rivers, to the close friendship between the African-American art critic, translator, author, and curator Henry Martin, and his companion, the outstanding Italian artist Gianfranco Baruchello. Their friendship can be traced in the drawings, books, and writing on show in correspondences about Henry Martin, the current exhibition at Arge Kunst. In 1983, the two men collaborated on writing How to Imagine, a narrative on art, agriculture, and creativity, a book that explored Agricola Cornelia, a rural utopian commune to the north of Rome, which worked from 1973 to 81 to bring agriculture and art into synergy. Reading Rivers takes up Baruchello's rhizomatic way of thinking and visualizing space and juxtaposes it with the voices of artist Emma Smith and anthropologist Anna Singh, who describe places as a web of relationships. How can imagination help us visualize a space as an open-ended structure or assemblage? Gianfranco Baruchello and Henry Martin, How to Imagine, a narrative on art, agriculture, and creativity. Excerpts selected by Carla Subrizzi for Nero Editions in 2018. One of these paintings of Agricola Cornelia is a kind of general vision, a sort of bird's eye view, an exploded bird's eye view, like those drawings of motors where you see all the different pieces that go into them. Well, this is that sort of vision of all the various pieces of land that we've cultivated here, the pieces that belong to us as well as the ones that belong to our various neighbors. And right next to these fields, I've written lists and descriptions of all the different produce that was grown on them. And over there, there's the field where we built the new gate, and you can see in the painting how the road runs right alongside of it. And there's also a note where it says that this is the field that I filmed from up in the attic, the film where you see the wheat as it grows through the course of a season. And aside from wheat, we also grow barley and corn and chickpeas, as well as two seasons of garlic. The first thing we grew here was chickpeas, which isn't much to brag about since chickpeas will just about grow anywhere. This whole painting is a kind of general description of the whole operation of Agricola Cornelia. It's a way, if you like, of remembering it all. It takes in everything from this sort of bird's eye view, and it's about all the surfaces that we've dealt with here. Just about the surfaces. These surfaces that sort of float in the mind without physical relationship to one another. The paintings, though, aren't really the point. I haven't even made a lot of them. What I'm talking about is Agricola Cornelia. And Agricola Cornelia is a great deal more than a dozen or so paintings, of which it's been more or less the subject matter. The paintings are a part of it, just as they're a part of everything I do. They're the one thing that's constant in my work. Other things come and go, and the paintings are the place where they leave a trace behind them. I know, moreover, what painting is, and other people know what painting is, or think that they do. We share the illusion that we all know what it is, and so that's no problem. But this time around, much more so than usually, the paintings are only a byproduct. Agricola Cornelia is like the package of newspapers that I hung up 5 years ago in a tree. I don't know what it is at all. It's simply something that I had to do. The idea with Agricola Cornelia was to deal directly with the essence of an experience independently of the paintings. The paintings are something that I used to call attention to things. So why not be interested in the things themselves? Agricola Cornelia is like the anomalous objects or the photographs or the film of the empty room. It's like all of the newspaper clippings, all of the things I've Xeroxed, all of the various ideas I've had, all the notes where I've tried to make sense of it, notes on the earth as connected to grottos and speleology, on earth and death, earth as germinal primordial matter, notes on the things we've grown, the garden produce, sugar beets, wheat, barley, corn, the sheep, pigs, the cows, but especially, most especially, there have been all of these notes on grottos and caverns. The idea then that we'd do better to return to the earth as an almost polemical reply to the exploration of space is the idea that I really started out with in this adventure called Agricola Cornelia. Or at least it's the first idea I had that I still think of as fundamentally important. Everything before developed into it or didn't develop into it. It was a way of making tabula rasa of the ideas that had come before it. It's the idea, finally, against which all of my earlier notions had to measure themselves. And even though it didn't just fall on me like a stroke of lightning out of a clear summer sky, it was still an idea that was more or less sui generis, in the sense that it was just there and hadn't grown out of any legible context. And it didn't at first become a part of any new context in which it could help give definition or meaning to any other ideas. That's how we started with this idea of experimenting something agricultural. It was all on really a very small scale, a few fruit trees, a little salad. But at the same time, all in all, I was still a very political sort of person. I'd been making films that I thought of as fundamentally political in their meanings. The paintings, too, were still full of political allusions, the facts they contained, their titles even. And so when Agricola Cornelia first began, it began in terms that were derived from these. It too had the pretense, the aspiration for a while of being a fundamentally political sort of gesture. It was through politics that I'd first made a formulation of an idea of a trans-aesthetic dimension to art. It was, in terms of politics and political consciousness, that I'd first begun to conceive of art as exemplary moral discourse. It was also a question of farming it from a very particular point of view. I was interested in the idea that farming this land could also be considered a work of art. Even the produce was a work of art. Farming this land was supposed, for me, to be a way in which it was finally possible to see the full political significance of a work of art. Agricola Cornelia became my way of responding to land art. It was an instrument of polemic with respect to land art, a way of openly expressing the sense of unease that I felt about land art, a way of calling its bluff and highlighting its confusions and its lack of any real understanding of the world we live in, its lack of any real understanding of the symbols it deals with. The disturbing thing about land art is that it's so aesthetic and all on such a terribly wrong scale. Anything that big should have other kinds of meanings together. Anything that enormous doesn't make sense anymore if it's entirely without awareness of the social realities inside of which and all around which it operates. And why is it that working with the earth can be art only if it's that way of working with the earth? Sure, growing potatoes may not be a very eloquent kind of protest, but that's part of what I became involved with too. I'd been saying for years that I paint little spaces because there are no more big spaces available, no more possible commissions for possible Sistine Chapels. And here suddenly were all of these people who simply hadn't noticed and who were beginning to work with bulldozers and construction companies and absolutely incredible amounts of capital, practically pretending that all of this new American wealth was a part of a society going through some sort of new renaissance. bulldozers, miles of trenches, trees wrapped in plastic, curtains across canyons, monumental walls and fences, kilometers of solid bronze tube, and no real sense to it. The polemic then was simply a question of deciding that the growing of potatoes is a work of art, of potatoes, or sugar beets, or corn, or yearling sheep, of growing them and then of giving them away, no, not even that, rather of growing them and then of selling them. That seemed an important innovation at a certain point. There have been any number of marginal art operations in the history of the art of the 20th century. Gestures, happenings, theatre events. Somebody once sold 10,000 square centimetres of earth along the Swiss border. I myself once set up a prison for words. There have been any number of marginal and experimental activities among the artists of this century. But it seemed to me that they were only accepted as art by the artists and by everybody else as well when they were content to stay inside of the precincts of the market of art. They were art if they were a part of the selling of objects or of paintings or of souvenirs or even of the artist as a kind of actor paid by the hour, a kind of glorified acrobat, a kind of glorified clown. It seemed to me that art should be able to go beyond that, that art could be a part of other kinds of commercial activities. Commercial activities really concerned with the satisfaction of needs, with concrete needs rather than diaphanous, snobbish social needs. Needs, I mean, like potatoes are needs. What you do with potatoes is to eat them. It was a question of pulling aesthetics into economy and of pulling the most rudimentary and fundamental forms of agricultural economy into aesthetics. And so much the better then if I was doing it with produce that came from land that didn't even belong to me. It was a real provocation. And talking about the art event of planting 10 pounds of seed in a field and then making a harvest of 86 tons of sugar beets is hardly any less scandalous than sending a urinal to an exhibition. There was a point at which I even prepared a proclamation. I even went so far as to call it Agricola Anti-Establishment. It was a text to be circulated among intellectuals and art world people, mimeographed, and it described our beat operation. It was a kind of press release, and it had a very polemical tone about it, as far as the intellectuals were concerned. It was polemical since it considered them the middlemen in the exercise of a certain kind of political and cultural power, and it invited them to give themselves over instead to create activities similar or analogous to what we were doing here at Agricola Cornelia, to things like the practical production of sugar beets. And it quoted Foucault, where he says that the plight of the intellectual is found in his duty to struggle against the forms of power of which he is at one and the same time both object and instrument. This idea of Agricola Cornelia as a kind of pseudo-political, pseudo-artistic happening always seems attractive since it at least has the virtue of a kind of concreteness about it, and everything Agricola Cornelia has been about since I abandoned that original idea, or rather when I abandoned that original idea, well, it becomes incredibly subtle, almost really too subtle to hold on to at all. Everybody always has a right to ask me what's the difference between what I'm doing here and what's going on at the farm just across the road, and it's difficult to give an answer. It's entirely a question of levels of consciousness, or rather, of ways of looking at things. Somehow or another, it's almost a question of my having been able to find a dimension of transcendence in things where transcendence is no longer frequently found. Not because it's no longer there, but rather because nobody bothers to look for it. Talking about Agricola Cornelia seems to become a question not of what I've done, but rather of how I've done it. It's a meditation on the modes of an activity, and that's a difficult thing to talk about. The discourse slips away into almost entirely intangible subtleties. I've been involved with Agricola Cornelia for 8 years now, and that means 8 years of trying to figure it out, 8 years of notes and attempts at writing texts. There's a whole packing case of the stuff by now. And every time I do it, all I end up with is a kind of fledgling poem in prose. And if this isn't aesthetics, what else could it possibly be? We've been involved in producing all of these living things. We've been growing plants and raising animals. And this food is something that's been the subject of a great deal of meditation. Even meditations on trucks full of sugar beets as they go out of the gate. If Agricola Cornelia ever becomes an object or a series of objects to be seen within the confines of a room, I'd like that film to be projected onto the walls of that room, maybe even onto the ceiling and the floor. It was a kind of meditation. I had to move, in fact, into a whole period of meditation and reflection, a period in which I had to rediscover certain capacities and certain intensities, certain intelligences that find their source as well as their explication in my painting. It was only with the use of these really fundamental concepts that I am able, for example, to go back to film again, to decide that film was an instrument that hadn't been exhausted for me as a result of its having been used as a means of political involvement. It wasn't until then that I began to ask myself questions like, what's a cave? Or what's the life of a man in a cave? What's the nature of our relationship with the ground, with the earth, with dirt? What was the meaning of the discovery of agriculture? What's a forest, a jungle? What's grass? And why do animals feed themselves on grass? These enormous quantities of grass that they eat, these beasts with their mouths always full of grass, these enormous quantities of grass that they're constantly turning into equally enormous piles of dung, dung that's used to restore and fertilize the ground and make the grass grow back again. This whole mysterious nitrogen cycle. That's all extraordinarily curious. This hunger that an animal has, this brute hunger that's almost like a madness, an obsession. A cow gets up in the morning and in the course of the day it goes through 300 pounds of grass that I feed into that enormous belly that it has. There are these cows out in the field now. They've been there all day, and they lie about and they go from one place to another, and they never stop eating. And then in the evening, they come back to the stable, and there's the hay here, and they launch themselves onto that as though they'd been going hungry, as though they'd been deprived of food and had had nothing to eat all day long. The way they butt each other, the cows attacking each other, and the bull too, all just to get this hay. And then when they're about to go to sleep, they regurgitate it up and keep on chewing on it more. And part of it is transformed into dung, and the rest is transformed into animal protein. And it's the same thing all over again with the sheep. We had a herd of 220 sheep. And you let them out into a meadow, and in the space of just a couple of days, it's cut absolutely clean, literally devoured. And all of this gigantic voracity is finally transformed. The thinking that leads me now through the experience of Agricola Cornelia is in fact an extension of an idea of testing the power of art against the power of the much more potent structures that stand adjacent to it. That's an idea that comes from a long way back for me. I've done things in imitation of industry, advertising, and finance. For example, I once did a one-man billboard. And I also did a series of banking events in a gallery. Things like selling 10 lire coins for 5 lire and 5 lire coins for 10 lire. And even tough things like this may not mean very much. They were still important for me. And with Agricola Cornelia, I've gone on to something more radical. From simply imitating the structures of social thought and action, the structures for the agricultural production of foodstuffs in this particular case, I've progressed to asking myself, what would happen if I actually tried to replace them? Emma Smith, Practice of a Place, excerpt from the chapter Place. In order to think about the practice of place, it is necessary to consider the nature of place. What is place? Where is it? What does it mean to operate in a situated way within a locality? What types of knowledge are required to navigate place, and which practices might we adopt to do so? Place means many things to many people, and multiple and shifting things to each person, even when sharing common localities, experience, and knowledge of place are intrinsically individual. Therefore, in considering the notion of place, my aim is not to define it, but rather to acknowledge its multiplicity as the manifestation of multifarious co-present realities. Network, meshwork, entanglement. In the 1900s, network theory evolved to provide a relational perspective of the world, encouraging us to focus not on elements but on the connections between them, where meaning stems from relation, and any pair of connected elements each can play an active part in the ongoing formation of the other. In this hypothesis, meaning occurs in the interval between points or objects, where relationships play themselves out in a space composed of intersections of mobile elements. However, the network metaphor logically entails that the elements connected are distinguished from the lines of their connection. Thus, there can be no mutuality without the prior separation of the elements whose constitution is at issue. Relationship becomes an operation whose effect opens up space to situate it, temporalize it, and make it function in a polyvalent unity of conflictual programs or contractual proximities. The relationship creates a space that is measurable, as the nodal model of the network retains a geographic and physical meter whose kinesticity is measurable and direction is observable. Spatial demarcation, when understood in a temporal matrix, is, like narrative, a process of ordering, of making sense of chaos through the imposition of structure. Such a conception of reality is driven by capitalism, whose framework it supports by being measurable, quantifiable, and visible. How then might we consider space beyond time? My interest in this question is informed by research into animistic belief systems, my experience living in Haida Gwaii and the Canadian Arctic, alongside Haida and Inuit, and an interest in contemporary anthropology, philosophy, and particle physics. For me, these fields, experiences, and trains of thought coalesce in the concept of intra-relation. Relationship is not an interval or space between us. It purely is and is all there is. Anthropologist Tim Ingold highlights how the establishment of relationships between elements, whether they be organisms, persons, or things of any other kind, necessarily requires that each is turned in upon itself prior to its integration in the network. The idea of intra-relationship undoes this inversion. Physicist and theorist Karen Barad can be given credit for the concept of interaction. She states, the usual notion of interaction assumes that there are individual independently existing entities or agents that pre-exist their acting upon one another. By contrast, the notion of interaction queers this familiar sense of causality, where one or more causal agents precede and produce an effect, and more generally unsettles the metaphysics of individualism, the belief that there are individually constituted agents or entities, as well as time and places. According to my agential realist ontology, or rather ethico-onto-epistemology, an entanglement of what is usually taken to be the separate consideration of ethics, ontology, and epistemology, individuals do not pre-exist as such, but rather materialize in intra-action. That is, intra-action goes to the question of the making of differences of individuals rather than assuming their independent or prior existence. Individuals do not exist, but are not individually determinate. Rather, individuals only exist within phenomena, particular materialized / materializing relations, in their ongoing, iteratively intraactive configuring. In the theory of intra-relation, as Ingold suggests, place is thought of as a meshwork rather than a network, where the distinction between things and their relations is collapsed, and things are their relations. The shift here is both seismic and subtle. In this conception, place can be seen as an ever-changing, mobilized relationship where the self is shaped not in relationship to the other, but through it. In this meshwork, place can be thought of as an entanglement where, within such a tangle of interlaced trails, continually raveling here and unraveling there, beings grow or issue forth along the lines of their relationships. Ingold describes this tangle as the texture of the world. He states, life does not emanate from a world that already exists, populated by objects as such, but is rather immanent in the very process of that world's continual generation of coming into being.
The Mushroom at the End of the World, Anna Singh. The concept of assemblage is helpful. Ecologists turn to assemblages to get around the sometimes fixed and bounded connotations of ecological community. The question of how the varied species in a species assemblage influence each other, if at all, is never settled. Some thwart or eat each other. Others work together to make life possible. Still others just happen to find themselves in the same place. Assemblages are open-ended gatherings. They allow us to ask about communal effects without assuming them. They show us potential histories in the making. For my purposes, however, I need something other than organisms as the elements that gather. I need to see life ways and non-living ways of being as well, coming together. Non-human ways of being, like human ones, shift historically. For living things, species identities are a place to begin. But they are not enough. Ways of being are emergent effects of encounters. Thinking about humans makes this clear. Foraging for mushrooms is a way of life, but not a common characteristic of all humans. The issue is the same for other species. Pines find mushrooms to help them use human-made open spaces. Assemblages don't just gather life phase. They make them. Thinking through assemblage urges us to ask, how do gatherings sometimes become happenings? That is, greater than the sum of their parts. If history without progress is indeterminate and multidirectional, might assemblages show us its possibilities? Patterns of unintentional coordination develop in assemblages. To notice such patterns, means watching the interplay of temporal rhythms and scales in the divergent life phase that gather. Surprisingly, this turns out to be a method that might revitalize political economy as well as environmental studies. Assemblages drag political economy inside them, and not just for humans. Plantation crops have lives different from those of their free-living siblings. Cart horses and hunter steeds share species but not life phase. Assemblages cannot hide from capital and the state. They are sites for watching how political economy works. If capitalism has no teleology, we need to see what comes together, not just by prefabrication, but also by juxtaposition.